Hello and welcome to Fueling Around with me, Jason Plato, and the man who leaves me uncomfortably numb is Dave Vitti.
Hello.
Fueling Around is powered by Adrian Flux. As UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Now then, Dave, how are we?
I'm very good, thank you. I'm excited, you know, today, and not just because this is the finale of the current series. That in itself is quite exciting. It's something of a milestone, but I'm excited about who we have to help celebrate this final episode.
Well, like you say, our guest today brings the curtain down on the current series of Fueling Around. And as a gentleman we've wanted to, you know, to speak to for this show since series one, which, can you believe, is 60 episodes ago.
And they said it would never last.
Well, I know, and there's been a few odd ones along the way, that's for sure. He's a musical legend and one of the founding members of the epic band Pink Floyd. He's got a car collection that is quite simply breathtaking. It is, of course, the one and only Mr. Nick Mason. Hi, Nick. How are we?
We're very well, thanks.
Thank you very much for joining us. As Jason says, we've sort of been on your tail somewhat for a while, so it's lovely to meet you in person and have you join us. I know that yourself and Jason have met over the years a few times. Where did your paths first meet? Presumably car-related, I suspect.
Yes, unless Jason was ever working as a road manager.
Oh, they wouldn't put me in charge of a big truck, that's for sure. I guess it would have been, you know, at some circuit.
It would almost certainly have been Silverstone, I think.
Yes.
But sort of quite when, I have no idea.
No. A few years ago, I didn't have grey hair, or silver, as I call it now.
It's sterling.
So Nick, are you in full production mode now at the moment for the tour in June? Because your current band, Nick Mason's Sourceful of Secrets, had set hit the road again. I mean, goodness God, unbelievable, eh?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I thought I'd retired about 20 years ago.
And do you still get the same sort of buzz being up on stage in front of thousands of people? I guess so.
Yeah, I mean, I think my doctor said, if you haven't grown out of showing off by the time you're 70, you're probably incurable.
It's a terminal thing. Yeah, no, but as I say, it's fantastic that you're still doing it. For those that are unaware, the band consists of yourself, obviously, Guy Pratt, Gary Kemp from Spandau Ballet, of course, Lee Harris from the Blockheads, and keyboardist Don Beckin from The Orb. In terms of this band then, Nick, was this a hand-picked dream team for you and something that you'd wanted to put together for a while?
No, in a word. I had very little to do with it. It was, okay. I think, initially Lee's suggestion, and the rest of the band sort of formed itself around us. When I looked at it now, we certainly didn't do anything as crude as hold any sort of tests for...
Auditions.
Yeah. No auditioning. It was actually, in a way, exactly how bands always used to be put together, which was a few like-minded people getting together and saying, well, let's give it a go. And that's exactly what we did.
And I guess you're playing a lot of, you know, old Floyd tracks as well. I mean, was the idea of that to introduce a new audience to some of the earlier stuff, or just because they're great bits of music?
A combination of things. First of all, it was a repertoire that I could just about remember, which helped. But the other thing was to that feeling that we wanted to sort of capture the atmosphere of the early music, and that meant that. Actually, it freed us up a bit because we didn't actually have to play Comfortably Numb exactly as it was played on the record. Yeah. We were playing the earlier songs where it was much more about the atmosphere that went with it rather than the accuracy.
Absolutely. And, I mean, presumably from an audience perspective, there's a lot of original Floyd fans, but, you know, is there a whole new generation that are coming through to see you?
Well, certainly... I think in a way that's one of the things that's really, really terrific is when you do get a younger fan or a fan base that sometimes they bring their old granny along who was, the clatter of Zimmer frames in the mosh pit is something to watch out for.
Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you what. My youngest daughter Zia is 14. She's just started about a year and a half ago. Started playing the bass guitar at school, and she's always had quite a good, like eclectic little playlist. But I've noticed in the last 8 months, she's playing Pink Floyd. You know. And it's great. She's got, and that's a genuine thing. And I'm like, where did you get introduced to that? Because she's 14 years old, but they're playing all this sort of stuff at school. So I mean, it's ace to see that.
Yeah, no, it's great. And the really odd thing is the way that people are adopting vinyl,
because
vinyl is now seen as the sort of perfect medium, and CDs are now dispatched to that box of old stuff at the bottom of the garden.
Well, it's still the most beautiful medium, isn't it? The album, you know, because it's analog and you get that lovely kind of richness to it.
Yeah, no one had anticipated that be the case, but they do prefer the sound of a vinyl record, which is actually, I mean, in terms of sonic quality, it's nothing like as good as a really good digital thing, but it just is more pleasant as a way of listening.
I think also it's to do with the fact that, you know, you're purchasing a piece of art, and you know, I don't know, don't mean to be sort of too pompous about that, but as well as the music, you know, there's also the physical artwork that you're getting with an album sleeve, and I think that's all part of the attraction and the return to vinyl these days.
Yeah, well, I mean, you have to. It was very odd the way that CDs just miniaturized all those album sleeves, and of course, once you're over about 17, you can't make out what the graphics are.
Your arms aren't long enough, are they?
Yeah.
Well, listen, Nick Mason, Saucerful of Secrets, kick off their UK tour on the 11th of June at the Victoria Hall in Stoke, and will be visiting York, Nottingham, Oxford, Bristol, Birmingham, Manchester, Glasgow, Gateshead, Cardiff, Poole, Brighton and Ipswich before performing at the Royal Albert Hall on the Saturday, the 29th of June, which will be epic. You must be looking, I mean, listen, you'll be looking forward to all of them, but the Royal Albert Hall at the end will be something else, won't it?
Yeah, it's a great venue. And I mean, we didn't actually start playing there, but we'd certainly in 1966 did a charity event playing there. So it's somewhere we've been revisiting for 60 odd years.
Hey, so anyway, promotion out of the way. Let's get on to the main course, because we've all got this love of cars. So, Nick, if you don't mind, straight away, what's in the current Nick Mason car collection now, and what are you currently driving as your everyday?
Well, we'll start with the everyday, which is a Golf R, which is just a really good, great, useful car. Well, funnily enough, the latest car, it might be the most unlikely, because it's a replica. The original car no longer exists, of an 1895 Benz, which is basically seen as the first motor car ever.
Wow.
Some years ago, a guy called John Bentley actually made 12 of these, I think. The idea was for a couple of museums, probably the Mercedes Museum in particular, who wanted this replica. And it seemed simple. I think while he was doing it, he thought, actually, I'll make a bunch of these. And they are the most amazing thing, because they do work. You can.
Do they?
They're unfortunately not entirely road legal, so I won't be turning up for that grand premiere.
I'm just looking at a picture with one now. Is it that's got like it's got almost got like a parasol roof on it. Is that right? That one, like penny farthing style wheels.
What it should look like is a sort of Victorian pram.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the original one is no longer. That's dead. That's gone, has it?
Yeah, that's gone. But obviously they had the drawings and some pictures of it and so on. And
Lord.
I think it was Mercedes themselves who commissioned the making of this replica. I haven't driven it yet, I have to be honest, but I'm told it's just as frightening as any super hybrid.
All 3.5 horsepower of it. You go steady.
You can still, you know, perfectly well, you can have an absolutely terrific accident really quite seldom.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So, I mean, famously, the car collection consists of the Ferrari 250 GTO. Aside, we'll come back to that in a second. Aside from that, what else is there, or rather, where did the collection begin, Nick?
Well, the first thing to say is that I never intended to be a car collector. Okay. I actually wanted to go amateur motor racing.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
And so actually the first car that I raced and still have is a pre-war Aston Martin. Mm-hmm. An Aston Martin Ulster. And as with all motorsport, there's always that mad idea that if you have your own garage, you will you won't have to pay to go motor racing.
Yeah.
Which is so wrong.
Oh, it couldn't be further from the truth, could it?
But it was fun. And so I started with the Aston, still got it, so I say. And then sort of gradually worked my way up through some historics and finally decided that in 79, mm-hmm. that what I'd really like to do would be some more modern racing.
And you went to, was that your first year at Le Mans? Which I have to say, you came second in class. Remarkable achievement.
Yes, probably a mistake on the part of the organisers. But no, it was terrific. It was everything I wanted to do, really.
And do you remember your first motor racing style memory as a kid? You know, where it first, you know, lit that torch in your head?
Oh, yeah, but that was inevitable because my dad was very into motorsport. Mm, yeah. And he actually worked for Shell as a film director, making documentaries mainly about cars and motorsport. And mm-hmm. eventually did a sort of five-parter history of motor racing. And he used to race himself, so I was taken to Silverstone in the 50s, I guess. Mm. That was the introduction.
And have you still got one of his old cars? Have you the Bentley 444? Yeah, the 4.5 litre.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good God, amazing!
And it was terrific. You know, the big treat was to go to Silverstone early Saturday morning, pick up. He had the guy who actually looked after the car was a guy called Wally Saunders, who'd actually been one of the original Bentley mechanics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and full of fantastic stories of that sort of era.
Oh, the Bentley boys, amazing times, right?
Yeah.
So I guess then, Nick, so when you were, I guess, when Pink Floyd were enjoying their early fame and success and all that goes with that, were you seeing the personal fame being something that might facilitate your racing career?
I didn't really initially make the connection because the sort of racing I was doing was unlikely to produce big sponsors. There's something about a 5-lap handicap that just doesn't do it.
I like it.
And so I loved doing it, but I just really kept it separate. Plus the fact that we actually worked really hard for that sort of the first 4 or 5 years. And there was very little money coming in, certainly not enough to do anything more serious than VSCC racing.
Yeah. And who was your first hero?
Oh, Sterling, I think.
Love it, yeah.
I mean, God bless him. My dad took me to one of the Grand Prix at Silverstone when Sterling was racing. And Fangio, in fact.
Yeah,
yeah.
And I think Sterling sort of remained a hero forever throughout.
Same with me. A true hero, that man. God bless him.
No, absolutely. I think we need to talk about the aforementioned GTO. You purchased this in 1978, was that right?
Yeah, I can never remember if it was the end of 77 or 78, but
that kind of era.
That era.
One of 39 cars at the time that were in existence, is that right?
Yeah. That people still argue about whether there's really 36 or whether you count, you know, which ones you count. But there are no more barn finds, I can tell you that.
No, absolutely. And without talking exact figures, it's fair to say that that car is worth significantly more now than it was on the day that you purchased it.
Yes.
I saw there was a lovely...
Someone else to fill in the details.
Absolutely. I saw a lovely little film from a few years ago when Brian Johnson, who's also been on here and joined us for a chat about cars, predictably, and he came to visit you and you took him for a little ride out in the 250 GTO. And I have to say that Brian looked like a little boy on Christmas Day. I mean, he looked so excited. It was incredible. It was just a lovely thing to see. I mean, you know, as someone who's into cars like yourself, for him to be in there and just smell and hear that car was just something else.
I think one of the wonderful things about the GTO is that it has that effect on, not only on all the sort of people who get a ride in it, but on me. You climb into it and you just think, this is magic. I mean, it's the ultimate gentleman's racing car, or if not a gentleman, at least a sort of wide boy, because it just, it's a really nice balance of power against road holding and so on. So nice to drive, easy to drive. I mean, I really appreciate that now when you can sort of climb into some hypercar and go incredibly quickly, but half the time the car's ahead of you. The great thing about the GTO is you're more or less you're with it.
I was given the opportunity to race one maybe 5-6 years ago at the Revival, and I did the test day there, and it was a real moment for me. But it's a sad ending, because in the week leading up to it, I put my back out on a mountain bike accident and couldn't. I had to pull out.
Really?
It was I remember sat on the sofa here watching Goodwin on the TV in all sorts of pain, and I had to turn it off. I couldn't watch. Tom Christensen jumped in for me and he won the race, and I had to, after like 2-3 laps, I turned it off and just sat there in a foul mood. But you're right, it's an amazing bit of kit, isn't it? And you feel at home, albeit I was a bit too tall because it's quite cramped in there, isn't it? But amazing bit of kit.
Well, nothing that an operation on your feet couldn't
do. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, get your priorities right.
Yeah. Here's a question then. I mean, would that be your favourite in the collection, or is it a bit like kids? You don't have a favourite.
Yeah, it's not that you don't have a favourite, but they do different things. So I've always say that I've got three favourites. And the first is the Aston Martin, because it was the first car I raced.
Yeah.
And my kids have raced it, and we've still got it. So that's great. I have to say, the other one is a Birdcage Maserati, because I had my best race ever in that.
Okay.
Won the support race to the Grand Prix in 93, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And I won it. I hope he hit... listens to this to remind him of that day. Frank Sittner, I beat Frank on the last corner of the last lap.
Oh, now that is a way to win a race, isn't it?
Yeah. You know what? I'll confess, I still occasionally watch the video.
And what? And absolutely. I'll get a text Frank later and remind him of that.
No, it's shameful, but I actually watched the video thinking, oh, I think I know.
I know what's going to happen here. Next.
And the GTO finally. Yeah, the GTO. GTO's the third car, just because of what I was saying earlier about it does everything. Mm. Though someone did point out, they said, is it the best investment? I was saying, you know, fantastic investment and so on.
Yeah.
And someone said, yeah, but actually probably the £7.50 that you bought your first jump kit with is a better investment.
Much overlooked is that one. But yeah, you're right. All eyes go to the GTO, don't they? But actually without the drum kit, without Floyd, you know, none of this perhaps would have been possible. So,
But here's the thing, though. In terms of the investment, it's not such a good investment after all, because you'll never get rid of it, because it's such a beautiful thing. So you're never going to realize. Do you know what I mean? So it just sits there, which is a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to say, actually, Nick, sort of on that front, you know, GTO aside, but is there movement within the car collection? Are you one of those people that can have something for a while and then feel that you're sort of done with it and then move it on? Or are you a keeper whereby once they become part of the family, they never leave?
Definitely the keeper. Mm. Yeah. I regret almost selling almost every car I've ever sold. Thinking about it, I do believe that one should really keep the cars that you use rather than keep everything. But it's very hard sometimes to part with them. And you know, I did sell an 8C Alpha that I had, and I had to sell it to pay some income tax. But I now know I should have gone to prison and kept the car.
Oh, that's a quote and a half, isn't it? That's brilliant. I love that.
I was going to say to you, when we were talking before about the likes of Goodwood and Silverstone and sort of classic meets where you have the opportunity to go and race your beautiful cars. Are you ever able to relax properly when you are racing something which is very valuable and well, arguably priceless in terms of what it means to you? Or do you always have half an eye on the fact that you just don't want to damage it?
I think once you get out on the track, you really just don't think about that. I mean, I've never thought, I think I'll back off a bit.
Okay.
Maybe I should not admit that. Maybe I should go, yes, it's always at the back of my mind. But Nick's right. Once you're out there, and you know, if you're on your own, you can have that mindset where, you know, I'm just on the limit. I'm not too much over it. But once you actually start racing someone, all those thoughts of I've got to look after this car, they kind of go to the back of your mind, don't they?
Absolutely. Like,
why have I said that? Why have I said that?
I think the other thing is that a little bit of sort of battle damage is acceptable. I had a very good moment with Martin Brundle when he was driving the car, and he actually asked me the question. He said, how do you want me to drive it, more or less? How careful should I be? And I said, well, I definitely don't want you bringing the car back looking like this. And it was polished beyond belief, ready for the outing.
Yeah.
I said, you need to go and race it, not...
Red rag to a bull, that is in my terminology. But interesting enough, this GTO that I was racing, I met the owner on the test day, and I said a similar thing. I said, look, if I'm racing these, it's not the three B's principle, is it? And he looked at me and said, you know, borrow it, bend it, buy it. I said, because I can't. And he said exactly the same as you. He said, oh, no, honestly, race it, because the value is in the car. Panels and stuff can be tickled absolutely. And fettled.
Absolutely right. And I think one of the things I'd say is that there are so few of these cars, but the owners are all pretty committed drivers. And there was a really nice thing. Every 5 years, they have a rally just for GTOs. And at one point, there was a day out at a circuit somewhere, and the organizers were sort of saying, have any of you done any racing or whatever? And almost every hand went up having a race license. I thought that was interesting. It was about maybe wealthy people, but their commitment to motorsport was there.
Absolutely. And I mean, for me personally, Nick, and obviously you've got some beautiful and varied cars in your collection, what is it specifically about Ferrari for you? What is it about that as a mark?
I think, it's the fact that they were there a long time ago, and they've actually stayed.
Yeah,
you know, even Mercedes drop in and out, or have dropped in and out over the years, and that commitment and the mystery of it, and the romance. You know, sometimes pretty sort of bleak with the accidents and so on. Yeah. There's a sort of story there that's important. Having said that, I'm a bit of a tart, really. The birdcage Maserati is possibly the best racing car of all of the cars that I've got.
And I'm assuming you would have met a few times, actually, Commander Tori, you know, at Enzo. Tell us a wee bit about that, if of course you did.
Well, sadly, I'd have to say I didn't meet him.
Oh.
But that was made up by my father, who did. And when he was actually making a film about the Mille Miglia. And the old man actually organized for my dad to get an Italian race license and drive with a privateer in a Ferrari and did the race with a camera strapped to him.
Oh, my word, wow.
It's that great thing where if you know the right people, you can get a competition license from the post office.
Do you know, I remember the first time, you know, a long time ago now, filming, was lucky enough to go to Fiorano and then went, you know, was shown around Enzo's, you know, his apartment there on the circuit. Yeah. And his room is left in exactly this as it was the day he died, you know, and his purple pen, because he wrote everything in purple, is on the desk. And, you know, there was there's one picture, one photo in a frame on his desk, and that's of Villeneuve, who is his... almost like his replacement son, if you like. But it was a real moment to walk into that room, and God, it just felt like it was back in the day. And of course, it is. And his flat, his house was on the circuit. Amazing.
Have you seen the movie?
Yes. What, the new one?
Yeah.
I didn't like it, if I'm really honest.
Mm.
It didn't do anything for me.
Number of people, you either sort of go for it or not. Yeah. But since we'd supplied a car for it, I'm a big fan.
What was it, Jason, though, about it? You know, was it just...
It just felt a bit hot Hollywood-y. It just didn't feel real, you know, and it was a bit overacted. Some of the car scenes were just ridiculous in terms of... I mean, it's probably because I can see it, A, from knowing how TV and stuff is made, which is a bad thing, actually, because it ruins some of the glamour of what TV is about.
Mm.
But also being involved in motor racing and knowing, well, actually, that little clip I've seen there, there's no way that can turn into a car going, you know, up in the air 60 foot. Yeah. It just was make-believe for me.
Yeah.
But that's probably my because, you know, because of my experience in the game, I guess.
Well, we're particularly fond of the film because not only did we lend a car, but we also sent my son-in-law to drive it.
Yeah, Marina,
And they suddenly realised that they were short of someone to play Castellotti. So Marino was then co-opted to become a film star. We were thrilled with because Castellotti had a lot of hair.
And we've got not much.
Yeah, some great still shots of Marino trying on various different wigs.
Oh, please, let us have some of those pictures.
As yet, I've been unable to prize them out away.
Ah, brilliant.
Do you still are you still a fan of modern day racing and modern day Formula One, Nick? I mean, Lewis obviously going to Ferrari. Did that sort of pique your interest?
I think for me, Formula One is still the peak of the whole business, and whether it's being fought out by the drivers or fought out by the designers, it's all part of that same thing. You know, if any of the teams can actually hold it together to win year by year, I think it doesn't make it boring. It makes it even more about the best of the best. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of Formula One. And I've, over the years, sort of been fortunate enough to go to quite a lot of the races, and it's always pretty intense.
Yeah. Do you know what, talking about the Lewis and Ferrari thing, you know, I can remember when, and actually I thought it myself for a while, you know, when he left McLaren to go to Merck, most of the world went, oh my God, what is he doing? And look what happened.
Yeah.
And I have a funny feeling he's got the timing just bang on. And I think in the very, very near future, we're going to see Ferrari back winning world championships again. Do you think that, Nick?
Yeah, I think it could be. You're absolutely right. Well, it's funny how wise you are considering what happened last weekend where Ferrari won too. Ah, the Obi-Wan Kenobi of motorsport. But, no, I think it'd be really interesting because it is that opportunity. And as you say, Lewis really chose well when to leave McLaren and go to Mercedes.
Yeah, I just got a feeling. I think it's going to become magical, and also to see him and Leclerc at each other.
Yeah,
that's going to be that's going to be a real treat, I think, because both, you know, Charles is real quality, I think.
Yeah, no, I'd agree on that.
In terms of like a motoring itch you've yet to scratch, what might those be?
Well, I am extremely old now, so I'm actually sort of enjoying more or less being the patron rather than anything else. I don't know. I suppose I'd still like perhaps to go back to Le Mans as an entrant rather than a driver.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that'd be cool.
Yeah, that's still... I mean, when I did Le Mans, it was totally brilliant because right up the front, there were the sort of professionals and the works teams. And then as you went further back down the grid, it was much more like a club meeting, really. And quite a lot of dropouts, which, I mean, it was a very different race to what it is now. It really is full on now from start to finish.
It's like a sprint race, isn't it, now? It's just like you say, it's flat out, absolutely flat out.
It's still on my bucket list, Jason, as we say every time. I've still never been, and I really need to. Every year we kind of go, right, we need to make a reason to go. So we'll have to cook something up, I think.
Well, get it down in the diary now. Block some dates out. Let's do it. We'll go.
We should do.
It's wonderful. We'll go as a spectator. It's quite something. It's a brilliant atmosphere. And actually, there's a huge amount of Brits which go over there. Maybe more than any other nationality, I would say. Yeah. Would you say that, Nick?
Oh, definitely. It's a sort of famous pilgrimage, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny, interesting, because it is absolutely Le Mans. It's not as though you'd get the same sort of crowd at the Nürburgring of Brits.
No, and talking of the Nürburgring, you took the 250 GTO over there, didn't you?
Can't remember. I haven't ever raced the GTO at the ring. No.
Have you raced at the old Nordschleife?
Yes, I did. I think won the last 1,000 races in, must have been 80, 81, something like
Tell
that.
Tell us about that. What's that like, racing around at the old Nordschleife? I mean, just insane.
Mm.
I was lucky. I really was lucky because Derek Bell was driving with Steve O'Rourke. And I think Steve got ill. And so suddenly I was at the ring and Derek had got the day off to give Steve a sort of coaching trip round and said, all right, well, we'll do it with you. So actually I had a day learning the ring, experiencing it.
Was that your first time round that day? I mean, was it from...
Yes.
Oh, my God. Well, I can't imagine you'd learn in a day. I would imagine it needs much more than that. Well, I know it does.
The good thing was that thing about returning the hire car at the end of it.
Yeah. Do you know what? I've been off, I think, three hire cars there over the years I've put through the gravel traps.
Have you?
What you really want to do is be able to go back to them and say, it's good news and bad news. And the bad news is the car's a write-off. The good news is we were second in class.
Yeah. Do you know what? I can't remember which... I mean, I can remember if I drive it now, but I can't remember the names. There's two sections on there where it looks like, on approach, like some other part of the track. But unfortunately, these two sections are very slow, but it ends up going slow off a quick bit. And every time I've got gone off, I've got it wrong. And it's uncanny. It's literally visibly almost identical.
Yes, there are. You're absolutely right. I remember that thing of thinking, is it left or right when I get over this hump? And of course, the other thing is, in the Harkar, you're about another foot higher.
Yeah.
Well, you see a lot more. So suddenly you're back down in a sort of race car, thinking, now where?
And you get that horrible feeling. We've all had it, you know, even on the road when you're about to, you think you're going to have a shunt. You get that rush of whatever it is. I think it must be adrenaline, which goes up your chest and floods your brain. Yeah. But that's nearly every other corner there, isn't it, round the ring? You get that feeling.
Aside from there, Nick, other favourite tracks that you've raced? Are there any personal favourites for you?
Well, I thought Laguna was quite fun. Mm. I think it's that thing where you just, you know, if you have the opportunity to go motor racing and you want to go motor racing,
yeah,
that's it. There's something a bit magic about Le Mans and the old Nordschleife and so on. But actually, just being out there, you know, the Club Silverstone with three corners, really.
Yeah.
If you're out there, it's sometimes quite alarming, but in other ways, it's everything you ever wanted.
I was going to say, it's all you need, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah. I mean, talking about Silverstone, I can remember the first time I went there with my dad in 76. And I can remember that moment. He was working with BMW at the time. It was he had a dealership. So we had hospitality and like center parking. And I didn't know what any of that was, but I can remember driving through the gates in a brown, I think it was a 635 or something, thinking, oh my God. We're driving into Silverstone. And, you know, years gone by, you know, having been a director of the place for 10 years, and I don't know, but hundreds of thousands of times I've been to that gate, I still get that feeling, you know, when going into that place. And I guess the same for you, Nick. It's somewhere special, isn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, mine's a sort of the art of course motor racing. Would be the way of describing it. Yeah. Pretty shambolic at times, but
yes, I concur.
But I'd look back on it and just loved it. And I have to say, you know, one of the great things about it are the other people who do it. You know, in general, fantastically helpful, you know, until you actually get out there. But in terms of assistance when something's wrong with the car or whatever, fantastic.
And also I think Silverstone has the best fan base of any Grand Prix, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's something really special about it, isn't there?
Yeah, do you know what? I think a lot of it goes back to the Mansell time, you know, when the first time that the circuit was... You know, there was that circuit invasion, and then he gave Cesena a lift back on his side pod. Mm. I think that's been a catalyst, if you like, for, you know, the British fan, and certainly what has happened over recent years with Lewis. It's an amazing experience, an atmosphere to be there.
No, I think that's true. And again, it has its own history with particularly Stirling, with the British Grand Prix and... Yeah, there's a lot of history there.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Nick, before we let you go, actually, much as we've talked about the incredible cars in your collection, I'm still intrigued by the everyday car in a really good way, because I think it's always interesting what, you know, when you have things like you have in the garage, I think that your choice of everyday thing is actually, because on the basis that you could almost have anything. What is it about the Golf R? Because I too think it's pretty perfect, actually, in many ways. It does everything well, doesn't it?
Yeah, and that slightly smaller car means it's just that little bit easier to wheel around town.
Yeah.
But it's very easy to load it up and carry a bunch of stuff. And it sort of does everything that... If you head for big cars... As far as I'm concerned, I'd like to sit in the back and read the paper.
Yeah.
Really. Yeah. You know, one of the things that depresses me slightly is the fact that all these cars now just get bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
You know, For me, I'd really like Ferrari to turn out another Dino.
Yes.
Because all these other things, they're big.
Yeah, they are, aren't they? Do you know what? I saw a picture the other day online of an old original Mini parked in an outside car park in between the lines next to a modern Mini. Mm. And actually, I thought the picture had been doctored. Because it's one's enormous, but if you look at all cars, you're right. They've all just got huge, haven't they?
It's obesity.
Yeah.
Well, I actually only yesterday, Jason, I saw the biggest Mini I've ever seen in my life, and by that I mean, and it must be a new model, unless my eyes were deceiving me, because it definitely had a Mini badge on the front, but it was far bigger than the Countryman or anything like that. Have they brought out like a Mini 4x4, it was huge.
I don't know. I don't think so.
I don't know. As you say, when you see the original ones now, they do. They look like toys, don't they?
Yeah, they do. Still, but I tell you, to get back in an old like Cooper S.
Yeah.
Oh, they're just great fun to drive. Yeah, they're
just
brilliant.
The way you bounce around, don't you?
Yeah. Hey, look, Nick. This next question is a question we ask all our guests, but actually, I can't think of a perfect guest to ask this question to. So he goes, we always think that music and cars go well together. So we'd like to ask you what your fantasy drive would be. So where are you? Where are you going? What are you listening to? But most importantly, what are you driving?
Roth. Probably the F40.
Yes.
That's because in terms of excitement, that car has probably frightened me more than anything else. particularly if it starts raining, which it normally does as soon as you climb into it.
Mm. Yeah.
Probably be going to a race of some sort, whether spectating or perhaps... And funnily enough, actually, the drive to Le Mans is good.
Yeah. And what's on the 8-track?
Joe Walsh, I think.
Okay.
Something, I mean...
I'm going to write that down because I'm not familiar with Joe Walsh. I'm going to write that down and check that out.
American sort of Eagles type. Mm,
from the Eagles.
Ah, okay. Yeah. So here's another little question. Do you ever listen to your own music? Or is that something which you just... No, never.
I mean, only if I'm sort of relearning or doing something.
Mm.
I've heard it before.
I suppose you hear it when you're doing gigs and stuff. You're in it.
Yeah, I've never really thought about that. I suppose, you know, most artists, probably the last thing they want to listen to is their own work a lot of the time.
Yeah, because it's... the trouble is you tend to listen to it critically.
Yeah.
You know, and you think, why did I do that? Or, why did we do this? Or, you know, we should have put one more verse in or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
I suppose it's like chefs cooking at home. They never do they?
Very good. Well, listen, Jason, I think on that note, I think you need to take us out.
Well, sadly, that is it for this show, but also for the series, which is a shame. But anyway, thanks for listening to Fueling Around, powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Dave, as always, thanks to you. But a huge thanks to our special guest this week, the one and only Mr. Nick Mason. Thanks, Nick.
My pleasure.
Nick, it's been fantastic having you on board. Thank you very much. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Jason Plater or at David Vitti. And if you like what you've heard, feel free to give us a 5-star rating, press the follow button and share the podcast on all your socials.
Well, that's it. This is the end of the current series. We hope you've enjoyed it. And, we'll see you again soon. Thanks for now.